Hi, it's Lou. I just wanted to let you know what's new and what's still around for Square Pegs in 2022. The Patreon membership is still up and running. The address for that is patreon.com/squarepegroundhole. And don't forget that W for the word hole. I really appreciate any contribution that anyone can provide to help me to keep this podcast going and to pay for some of the ongoing costs associated with it. It's very, very much appreciated. So thank you so much to my Patreon members as always. Something I did develop at the end of last year was a new website. On that website, there are podcast episodes, transcripts, there's a huge resource library, there's news and information on advocacy projects. The address for the website is squarepegroundhole.com.au. Many people know I have two Facebook groups or pages. There's a public page and there's a closed group. Please feel free to apply to join the closed group. It's where we discuss a lot of the episodes and some of the advocacy work that we're working on. And I just finally wanted to say it is my only ambition to speak on behalf of parents when I speak. I will never speak on behalf of any group to which I cannot represent with lived experience. I don't speak on behalf of neurodivergent people. However, I am very happy to bring neurodivergent people along to discussions and to share with us all. Thank you so much for listening to my podcast. I hope you find it helpful. Thank you. And thank you so much to my two latest Patreons. They are Jane and Victoria. Just come through today. Thank you so much, both of you. You are very, very much appreciated, and I would love to see what I can do to help you. I would like to acknowledge that this podcast meeting is being held on the traditional lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and pay my respect to elders, both past, present and future, and to welcome you to this new episode for podcast Square Peg Round Hole. Welcome to Square Peg Round Hole, the podcast where we discuss diversity and how to embrace our neurodivergent kids at home, at school, and in the workplace. I thought this day would never happen. Finally, I am actually interviewing someone I've wanted to talk to since I began the podcast. Today's guest is Chris Varney, and Chris is the only guest I've had so far to decline any heads up about questions I'm going to ask him. He obviously knows exactly what he's about and is deeply passionate about his community and the goals he is striving for. He wants to embrace the autistic community, and the organization he founded has led the way. Chris had a dream many years ago. He dreamed that instead of constantly hearing everything that autistic youth were told they can't do, they should embrace all the amazing and wonderful things that they can do. Who likes the sound of that? Yep, me too. I've always admired Chris and his baby, as he calls it, the I Can Network. Today we get to hear everything that drives Chris and why his purpose is to prove what autistics can do. Welcome to the podcast, Chris Varney.
Thank you so much for having me, Louise. It's an honour to be here.
Oh, you're so sweet. Thank you so much. I can't believe we're actually doing this because you have been a hard man to pin down to this.
I'm sorry. I'm very sorry.
No, I'm happy. I got you. I'm looking at you. I'm recording your voice. This is what I've been wanting for a while. So thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. So, Chris, I'm going to say something to you. This is your vision, I believe, a world that embraces autism.
Yes, absolutely.
That's my vision too. I don't know if you've seen, but my website's got a very similar phrase to that, a world that can embrace our neurodivergent community. And so great. That's what we're going to have a lovely talk about today. I usually start with icebreaker questions. So You don't know what they are because you're my only guest who I haven't provided questions for. So this is going to be interesting.
Here we go.
The first question is, what is your favorite animal, Chris? And a why lion. Is that your favorite animal? Oh, what was
lions,
that?
Lions. I really like the mane. I really think they're fascinating. I think they're incredible primal creatures that are impressive. And yeah, I mean, they have a story of ups and downs. The men are a pretty isolated group, but then they, you know, join a pride by conquering it, and the women are doing all the work, and it's just a hardy life they lead. But I just find them so fantastic and majestic to look at. I don't think their way of life is great. I don't think what they do is great, but I think that aesthetically, I think they're an amazing, amazing creature on the planet.
Yeah, I could agree with you on that. Isn't this funny? I had a recent guest, it wasn't the last one, it was the person before that, said lion as well. So I think that's quite interesting because it's not the sort of, you know, most people say koala and dog.
Yeah, mine is, it's not a cute answer, is it? It's a,
no, but
I'm afraid of them. I don't want to hang out with them. They're not something I ever want to be near, but I think they're very impressive.
Yeah, I agree. They are. They're beautiful. And my next question for you is, if there was one thing you could change in this world, Chris, what would it be and why?
It would be the shame that autistic young people feel about being autistic. I think that is an unfortunate social construct that decades of misinformation has achieved, and something that is a wonderful, unique, natural part of autistic young people is something that they question, that they avoid, that they push against, because we live in a community that very much avoids labels. And when kids are being brought up in early childhood centres and playgroups and primary schools, it's the kids who are a bit unusual that sometimes don't fit into the children's play dates and the rigmarole of that routine. And it's those parents that feel incredibly isolated, and that impacts lots of decisions that families make about disclosing or not getting a diagnosis or getting a diagnosis. And some young people have a fantastic outlook on their autism. They've been raised in a positive environment that's very much wrapped around them an I can attitude. And that was one I was raised in, credit to my grandparents and my parents. But unfortunately, many young people from a range of stakeholders have been made to feel ashamed of being autistic. And that is what I would change.
I relate to what you were just saying so much, of course. Now, if we could just move into you telling us a little bit more. You've just alluded to some of your life growing up. I know there's a very interesting story to you. So could you tell us a little bit more about how you found yourself doing what you're doing today and what connection that has to the concept of this podcast name, Square Peg Round Hole?
Well, I had always loved working with young people. I had, and where that came from was I developed connections and friendships through structure. So the structure of my parents' family friends was a very safe one, and that's how I formed some great relationships outside of school. But in school, I didn't necessarily make friends easily in the playground or the classroom. It was through activities, whether it was some sporting teams. I wasn't a big sports nut, but I was in some at least. And committees at high school, I was a committee kid. I did the student representative council. I did a lot of those types of activities. And that always provided very clear rules and boundaries around friendships and connections. And that meant that because I was a kid that was found it easier to talk to people older than me, I made friends with young people in older year levels. And where that led to was I got involved in lots of out-of-school activities through Student Representative Council. That led to a long involvement with World Vision Australia and World Vision International through 40-hour famine and things like that. And all of that, that was all important because I gained social confidence through this structure of committee and community involvement. And so that you know, that really helped me work on my anxiety. It helped me improvise better. It helped me cope with surprise better. It helped me manage some of my genuine challenges, and it helped me leverage my strengths more. And eventually I developed confidence to the point where I was older and talking about being autistic in some audiences, and I realized that people looked at me as though I'd somehow come down a few pegs in their mind. And they really did look at me as this exception, not the norm. And when, you know, it was the autistic community, I guess, met me with a bit of shock, a bit of surprise. And I realized that I was stepping into a space where a lot of autistic young people had not had as positive a schooling as I had had. And a lot of them had not been given the access to the types of student committees and types of student activities I had been. That was the starting point. You know, year seven was, I was given great access. I was sponsored by year level coordinators to do things. And that was, you know, that really gave me permission to just keep doing and achieving those types of things. But I realized when I got older and I was speaking about being autistic, that it was this simple thing that autistic young people were not being given access to those types of opportunities to mainstream them, help them develop their confidence. And then equally, when I was starting to work with autistic young people, there was such a sense of overwhelming shame. I was walking into a sector, and it's very different now. This is, you know, this is now 9-10 years ago. I was walking into a sector which did not have proper decision-making spaces for autistic young people, did not have a view of autistic people actually running the services to support them. It was very much in a patron-client paradigm that was absorbing what the medical model said autism was, and it wasn't socializing that through a community development, community empowerment model. It was very much just repeating textbooks and research. And we need textbooks, we need research. I'm not having a go at the professions behind them. What I'm saying is that the movement and the discourse hadn't developed to a point where autistic young people had self-determination. And that, you know, that's been rapidly growing, which is very exciting. And I'm not saying that I can network necessarily started that. I think we were a pioneering autistic-led organization, no doubt about that. But I think the movement was there. And I think we were a bright light that pushed parts of that movement forward. So that's how I found myself doing this. I'd had a blessed run from about 13 to 22, and I'd had a lot of access to mainstream opportunities. And it was when I was 22 and turned around and started talking about that and realized that the story I was telling was just so outside the norm and frighteningly so. And this wasn't a story that was exceptional. It was just, you know, I'd had some access. This wasn't anything that was extraordinary, but I guess what hit me was, oh my gosh, it just hasn't happened for enough people. And it might be that what I'm dreaming of requires someone to do it. And I think that someone has to be me. And that took me a while to accept that.
Well, that's why I've always related to when I've heard you talking, is I've felt like you're an older version of what I hope for my own child. And when I've heard you expressing it this way, of course, when all of that was happening to you, as you say, it was like 10, 20 years ago or whatever. And so it would have felt even more unusual. Whereas these days there are more people that are having more positive experiences. But yes, I really relate to that. And I've always looked at you and related to your mom, I guess.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Thought about when you talk about your mom and the experiences of your parents and grandparents, I hope my child grows up to talk about us that way, you know. So yeah, I can understand what you're saying. And I want to talk to you more about what I heard there was there's some low-hanging fruit, and I want to talk to you more about that as we go through. But before we get to that, my next question was, I guess, I've heard you describing this before, and I really like the way you say it. So my question is, being autistic is not linear, is it, Chris? So can you explain that further?
Yeah, this isn't from me. This is from a visual.
Oh, well, I still like it.
Yeah, this is from a visual put together by Rebecca Burgess.
Okay.
It talks about autism as a circular spectrum. You know, people don't autism is in a linear spectrum. People don't fit down one end of a end or the other. We're in a circular spectrum. It's like a sphere of strengths where people have different motor skills, different linguistic strengths, different sensory needs and preferences, different perception, different executive functioning skills. All of us, you know, we have our own unique area of the autistic spectrum, if you like, across that sphere. So yeah, that's not from me though. We promote that view, but it's I can't claim that.
Oh, well, that's all right. You describe it very well.
Yeah.
I think the thing that I noticed when you described it when I heard you before was you use the word differences rather than deficits or impairments, which is what we all used to hear so much more.
And I know
I have just like moved myself away from that, but there's still a whole lot of people that are thinking that way. So I like that. I really liked that. Thank you. And moving further into that realm, I want to ask you about authenticity, identity, and self-awareness. Can you please tell us a bit about your experience of self-awareness and understanding and why using identity first and strength-focused language, as we just discussed, why is that so important?
Big question. So I think self-awareness, everyone's on their own journey with self-awareness. I guess I was raised in a family where it was a very typical, very much embraced that kind of she'll be right Aussie culture. I won't say it's like a typical Aussie family. There's a very diverse view of that now, which is very good. But I was raised in a she'll be right culture where, your challenges were something you took in your stride. You had a bit of a laugh at them, but you definitely played up your strengths and you stick to what you knew. That was very much the world I was raised in. And I guess to put some actual faces to that, I was a young carer to my grandfather on and off during school holidays. And when you were a kid like me and you had a lot of anxiousness and you were very selective with who you trusted to be your friend, you were very, very careful about where you hung out. And I had one sanctuary, which was my grandparents' house. And I will get to self-awareness from this answer, but basically I hung out with my grandparents a great deal. They were incredibly important because they could reinforce the messages my immediate family were trying to give me, messages which were positive or messages which were, you know, feedback, you know, whether it was you can't take over the kitchen table for your homework, you can't. You know, you share a room with two other brothers, you've got to consider them. And I guess when you're young, you're still learning how to manage your autism. And it's a big thing to learn to how to manage. You know, there's no moment you've mastered it. But when you're 12 and you're very confused about your reactions and responses to things, you know, that's full on. So I was frequently at my grandparents' house for my own respite and, to be honest, my family's respite. And I grew very close to them, and it was through that relationship that I gained a lot of self-awareness about my strengths. I could be very caring, so probably my first responsibility as a teenager was, you know, being able to look after my grandfather when my grandmother wanted a break, because he was wheelchair bound. He needed assistance going to the toilet, showering, being put to bed with his medication. There was a need to give him some activities for his own physical exercise. You know, all of that young care relationship really did give me a lot of self-awareness of what I could do. It was a very athletic family, so some of my struggles really stood out. Some of my strengths really stood out because I was great. You know, I had a great imagination that I could channel into written form, which was lucky. And so it was that relationship, caring for someone else, that really showed me some self-awareness. And obviously getting involved in different committees, there's always feedback mechanisms in committees, and that again helped me develop self-awareness. Authenticity is a bigger thing. I think authenticity, you know, you have to be pretty brave to be fully authentic, don't you? It's a terrifying thing.
Yeah.
It's a really terrifying
thing. I think a lot of these things take a lot of bravery.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think I was exposed to some amazing leaders growing up. So World Vision, you know, being exposed to a person like Tim Costello, he was a very brave leader, and he could be very brave on many different issues and could really stick his neck out and take risks. And I really learned a lot from him. And I've always been attracted to brave leaders. And at my high school, I had a Year 7 coordinator who was also very brave. She had a very magnetic effect on her parents and students. She believed in the individual strengths of students. She wasn't an expert in autism. She was just extremely passionate about networking her students for their success. So I guess the ICANN in ICANN Network came from my relationship with my grandfather, because it was this mentoring and caring relationship which changed me for the better. And the network in ICANN Network really came from this teacher, because she was such a capable networker. And so that, yeah, they really, those relationship with my grandparents and this teacher was what developed that self-awareness and authenticity. And I guess you keep meeting, you know, I think the universe is always trying to help you work out your path. And people kept being put in front of me who were authentic leaders, who did things outside the box. And to be honest, it took an enormous amount of courage to create ICANN Network. And one of the influences was probably a bit more mainstream than these more local examples, was an example of Eunice Kennedy Shriver. You know, she was JFK and RFK's sister. She's the fifth in the Kennedy family, and she created the Special Olympics. And the story in how she did that was incredibly unconventional, was incredibly brave. And when it was 2013 and I was dreaming up ICANN Network and starting to put ideas to paper and start to organise people and events, it was her example that was a huge inspiration to me. So That's the answer.
Oh, well, I think that's lovely. And yeah, of course, we all have these sort of light bulb moments or people that stand out in our memory, don't we, that are important to us and sort of change our course. And we refer back to those people a lot, which is very interesting. I've heard you talk about your teacher before. I remember seeing a picture of her and everything.
Yes. Oh, she was an extraordinary human. I'm not the only one that says that about her. And there were other people she impacted as well.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah, my son had somebody like that too, so I can relate to that as well. And that's what my next question is going to be about education. So as you would know, neurodivergent students are overrepresented in school exclusion data, and I do a lot of advocacy as a parent around this. There's disengagement from education, and sadly, often, eventually, the criminal justice system comes into play. In your opinion, what is the underlying reason why education is such a nightmare for neurodivergent Australians?
Well, our training of education professionals and the systems in which we, I guess, promote education and sponsor it, and the framework which informs the development of decision makers in education, has all previously been very focused on academic achievement and a certain form of success in school, which was high marks in the year 12 and a pathway to university. That's the conventional model that education is set within. And the process of getting there down, you know, on the local street, there's people that talk about a dream of going to a private school, which has a very selective approach at times in their enrollment. And then there's government schools called state schools that mandated to take locally zoned kids. And one issue is the training, and one issue is the system and the framework around it as well. And all of that isn't very friendly for neurodivergent young people who can have very different achievements, can be the academic whizzes and the ducks of year 12, can transition to university, but there's others that express success and achievement in all sorts of different ways. And what we've been doing over the last, I'd say 20 years, is really trying to change that. Education systems are working very hard to change that model, but it is trying to rewrite so many different pages in this enormous book called Education. It is intense. It's going to take easily another 25 years of reforming pieces of legislation, frameworks, strategies. It's an intensive thing because everyone gets to education and comes at it from their own education. And so it's influencing the way that multiple generations have understood autism, because you get a new decision makers coming in with a particular worldview. And if their worldview has been that autism is a deficit and the current system is working and we just need to strip it back to basics, then we have to work again at educating them. So it is intensive. It's a symptom of the need to educate mainstream Australians on, you know, all the strengths of being autistic. And when we achieve that, you rapidly have people get to the right pages of the book that they control or influence, and they start to make a difference. So it's, you know, if you take a typical school, we can work through it. It's making sure that when principals are in their job, that they have an appreciation of the strengths of autistic young people. And many, many, many do. I could fill an assembly hall with the principals I've met who are extraordinary champions for autistic students. And then it's also influencing the wider parent bodies. Many parents will quietly question whether they're, you know, why is their young person put in a room with so many other students that have neuro differences, for example. There's a lot of questions that get asked in quiet spaces of schools, and it's trying to influence the mainstream community to, you know, to understand and embrace autism. So it goes back to the, you know, the vision of both of our organisations. It's, and I guess education is this space. Australia's many different education systems, we're all in this process of reform. Each one, Queensland to WA, Victoria, Northern Territory, they're all working very hard to change it. I haven't seen any system not on the journey. And all of them are at different stages. Queensland has some fantastic indicators and metrics in place to understand how it's being successful for disabled students. Victoria has a $1.6 billion package being put into the disability inclusion funding package to reform, you know, the whole experience that autistic, neurodivergent, disabled students are having in schools. So there is, huge room for optimism, but it is an enormous process.
It's enormous, and it is going to take time. I agree with you 100%. And, you know, the leadership is also a really good point that you make. That's so very important.
Yeah.
And, of course, you know, the interface between federal and state education systems and departments, that's a big thing as well. So, yeah, look, of course, I'm not surprised you answered it that way. Okay, so my next question, I'm just starting with, I guess, a statement. One of the commitments I've made with this podcast is to facilitate neurodivergent voices and perspectives. I do not speak for autistics or any group to which I don't belong. I speak as a parent, and I want to help other parents, teachers, employers, therapists, etc., to understand what neurodivergent people are telling us. So my question for you, Chris, as a representative of the community and having such insight and connection with your mentees and your clients and young people, what would be some of the most common messages that young autistics want us to hear?
I think they wanted to be accepted for who they are. I think a lot of them just want to be themselves. I think that can mean sometimes that they want people to understand autism. And I think for some of them, sometimes that is they don't want to talk too much about autism because they are who they are and they want to focus on their interests and their connections and their mates. So it's, you know, young people are very, very diverse. In our program, we have phases where young people want to talk about their autistic strengths, some of their challenges, and sometimes they don't want to talk about autism at all. They just want to connect with their mates that I can. You know, there is no universal view or agreement about what young people want. It doesn't exist. It's just there's lots of different messages that we hear. But it is possible to drill it down to the simple message of people should be accepted for who they are. And everyone wants that. Everyone wants to have that lovely freedom of self-belief, not feel trapped by the misconceptions of others. So I think that's always a responsible youth plan. Yeah. You try and set up lots of different lots of different avenues and options for young people.
Yep.
To be who they are.
Yeah, well, you're doing that. Thank you.
Hopefully.
Yeah, well, you certainly look like you are to me. And the other thing I really value is I often see fantastic quotes that you release from the mentees expressing how they feel. And I try and share as many of those as I can because they resonate so much often. Sometimes I just think, did they actually talk to my child? Like, it's actually what he says all the time. So I can really relate to a lot of that. That's great. And I'll continue to do that. So can you tell us a bit more about why did you create the ICANN network? What services does it provide? And can you add into that the importance of it being an autistic-led organization?
Mm, yeah, great, great questions. I created it because I saw a huge gap. I didn't see a program that empowered young people with an ICANN attitude, really immersed them in an environment which promoted their strengths, which allowed them to be themselves. And so the purpose I had was to create a mentoring program which promoted self-acceptance, autistic pride, positive identity, belonging, optimism, and above all, confidence. I wanted to see autistic young people confident in Australia, and the school program and the camp program were my first avenues to achieve that. And then I had this idea around online mentoring, which had a wonderful friend and colleague in my team named Kristen, who was an enormous support of. And after that, we went to our board and said, we've got this vision for an online mentoring program, which translates our school program, which was in Victoria and Queensland, but not interstate. And so, we set up an online mentoring program nationally, which has been, you know, a lifeline for young people during COVID-19 and has grown 300% during COVID-19.
Wow.
So there's 1,300 young people in our national online mentoring program. In Victoria and Queensland, there's 107 schools in our primary school and secondary school mentoring programs. And then we also deliver professional development workshops where we share our insights. Altogether, we approximately have 64 autistic staff now, which is really fun. It's an amazing life. I can say both being an autistic employer, CEO, and having so many awesome autistic staff, they're an incredibly loyal, passionate, generous, quirky, funny, hardworking, authentic, innovative, resilient, determined, beautiful colleagues. So it's it is a really fun life. No day is ever uninteresting. Never dull.
I bet.
Never dull. So yeah, I'm always learning. It will take me a long time to unravel everything I've learned.
Yeah. Right. Wow. It's had a massive impact on you personally.
On me personally, and I think on many communities. I think ICANN has been blessed to have a huge impact. I don't know. I'm always going to say that as founder and CEO, ICANN is my baby in my head.
Yeah, of course.
So I think for a lot of people, it has made a huge impact. I think for many people, this filled a void, and we're very lucky we played that role, and I hope we keep playing a huge role.
So do I. I want you in New South Wales. I've been saying that.
Yes, many people do. We do have a dream of being in New South Wales. We just need to get the steps right, because I've learned the hard way. You can have a big vision, but you need to have the administrative steps and frameworks in place to be able to do it. So
I'm sure my team know what it takes. Yeah,
I do. We've just got a little bit way to go.
Right. Okay. Well, we'll just wait patiently. Can you tell us about, I know you touched on, I know about the online mentoring programs that are interest-based, which are just fascinating and amazing, and I bet they're really successful because I can just imagine.
The interest-based programs have great data behind them. Yes.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And I'll share some more information. I'm often recommending to people parents that contact me about those. And that's something New South Wales people can access as well, I'm assuming. So, but with the school mentoring and the professional development, is it professional development for teachers or do you? Yes. And when you go into the schools, what sort of responses do you get and what sort of things are you discussing?
Yeah, in my humble opinion, you can go in with technical strategies and practical tips. At the end of the day, people want stories which reinforce for them fundamental truths that you take everyone as they are. You don't have any misconceptions or preconceptions of what people, who they are and what they can achieve. And if you believe in someone and they have trust in you and you create a safe learning environment, there's nothing your students can't do. And you can have as many technical strategies as you like and formulas and worksheets and methods for educators or workplace professionals. But at the end of the day, the most important message is to remind humans, you know, about the joys of being human and discovering other natural strengths in other humans. When people connect with that fundamental experience of being human, time passes and they're having an experience in your PD workshop. So it's the story which reminds people who they are and what they can achieve, and that gives them energy. And that's really, people don't normally write that down. People normally say, I want a workshop that gives us practical tips, or I want resources, etc., etc. I want these tools.
Yeah, they do. Yeah.
But at the end of the day, what the feedback forms I read where they get the most impact was, you know, the story that brought them back to their why they're doing what they're doing. Because when they're connected to the why, suddenly they know what tools they need. They know what tools to create. Humans love creating things. You know, no one really... people do like learning from others, but people also like creating. So, you know, a lot of the time that's what I, and it's just connecting people to that. I know it sounds so simple, and it does take sometimes a bit of artwork to get people there. That's, you know, where I always see the most impact. It's helping people remind them that they just need to believe in people, achieve trust, and create a safe learning environment.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that coupled with confidence, because what I often see is that at first lack of confidence, but if that confidence can be built within the teachers, they feel like they are in control of what they're doing, and then they can embrace that, wow, I can see what effect this is having on that young person's life. Yes. And I'm a part of that. And so then that builds, doesn't it, the confidence.
Yeah.
I've seen that happen before, which is wonderful. That's great. I was just wondering what was happening with those classes, so thank you. What I wanted to talk to you more about, which is a question that kind of comes from this discussion, is this concept of the low-hanging fruit. So this is just my perspective. People who have neurodiversity-affirming practices accept that that is the way they want to be and the way they want to see and interact with the autistic community. And then there's still those that are reticent through either lack of awareness, lack of education, or whatever. You know, they just haven't come on that journey yet. So I'm sure the low-hanging fruit are very easy for you to help because they want to be helped, they want to see things a certain way. What's your feeling about the approach towards those that are not yet there, that are still doing behaviorism and, you know, the rewards and sanctions and sort of the neurotypical way of being? You know what I mean?
I think what you're articulating there is the gap between current policy and practice, because for me, the low-hanging fruit, there's certainly enormous, you know, several pieces of legislation and several education strategies at a state level in Australia that have written down that the way forward is an inclusive classroom and inclusive schoolyard. There are complexities with that. What does full inclusion mean? Because in Australia, we also have this unwritten rule around parent choice, and the diversity of the community is reflected in the sheer diversity of schools that we have. And the fundamental thing about anyone that has kids is you love your kids more than anything. You do anything for them. You lay down your life for them, and you never want to see harm come to them. And so parents will move heaven and earth to find the right learning environment for their kid. And yeah, they just want their kid to be happy and healthy. And they'll look at any school differently to find a space that answers that for their kid. But in terms of achieving the low-hanging fruit, I think the policies and pieces of legislation we have are strong and will keep getting stronger. But I think it's actually the how of making those words a reality. How do you translate that into frameworks that influence the learning and professional development of people in this education system. How do you influence the way in which they're promoted in their jobs, they're developed in their careers, all of that? That is huge. It's a management HR. It's a really big process. And there's been some amazing wins. You know, it takes enormous energy and leadership to achieve that. That's just a long-term process. I know that's not the low-hanging fruit. I think the fact that we've got things like the Every Child with a Disability Succeeding strategy in Queensland, which is such a bright light in education plans, and the fact that we've got the disability inclusion package, and the fact that we've got a Royal Commission into disability abuse and neglect, the fact that we've got so many more schemes coming out to support disabled students and the NDIS and all of these things is absolutely picking up the pace of, educator understanding. But it is still a long-term process.
As we still have positive behaviour for learning and social skills programs that are embedded deeply in everything, not just education.
Yes.
I just wanted your thoughts on, I guess it's a bit philosophical or up there in the sky, but, you know, just what do you think we can all do to try and move that paradigm shift that's required to move away from the old school?
Well, the answer there is simple. It is what you want. If you can articulate it in words or written form, in any sort of representation, and convey it to people in power, whether that's the local principal, whether that's the local area executive director that principal reports to, or the regional director in the education system, or the secretary of the Department of Education, or the minister, or your local MP, to keep talking about it. You will get somewhere. If you can talk about it, whether it's through a video, whether it's through a drawing, whether it's through a picture, whether it's through writing, talk to people about it. It does go, those things do go places. And it's been through that, through multiple decades, that we've had the developments we've had. You know, call for inquiries, call for commissions, call for public voice to be opened up on an issue. Just keep talking about it. I know that sounds like it's so simple, but yet overwhelming, but that's how change happens.
So interesting you should say keep talking, because that's all I'm ever saying is I want parents in my situation anyway to come forward to do. I've always got these calls to action happening, and please write to the MPs and say this, and please, you know, so we are doing that, and this podcast community are doing as much as we can, and I'm always on at them about it to try and get.
But that's amazing that you are, because it does. It's so important that we do that. We have to. We have to keep that alive.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we you go.
Sorry.
No, it's your podcast. You go. I am your servant.
Oh, I get a bit carried away too. Don't you worry. Yeah. Well, I was just going to say, I hope that people listening to the episodes, because like you're going to motivate people. And I had Peter Hutton on the other day, who I don't know if you know him, but yes, you do. You're nodding. So he's a fantastic entrepreneurial ex-principal, but that direction is where parents are saying we want to go.
And yes.
So the more they hear your voices, I hope that's why I'm doing this, so that they get motivated to do something.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
Exactly. It takes all types, doesn't it? If you look at social change theory, you need the reformers, the rebels, the citizens.
Yes.
And the, what is it, the change agents. And,
You
know, Peter Hutton, rebel.
He's
a rebel in the social change theory.
He was such a rebel too, I can tell you. He refused to answer certain questions to me.
Well, you have to have that. All of them have that.
Yeah, no, I loved it. Yeah, it was great.
In this journey with ICANN, I've had to play all four roles at different times. Certainly starting it was a rebel. It felt like such a rebel. And then there's also a reformer. There's a space for a reformer. Did I say that? Rebel reformer, yeah.
Rebel reformer, change maker, yeah. I want to do one of those social valorization courses. I've got that on my list of things I want to take part in. I have one final question for you, Chris.
Yes, yes.
And this is about research.
Yes.
So I know you've conducted research about experiences of your wonderful clients and people you work with. And I was wondering if you could share some of the key points about the barriers they're facing, or, you know, through COVID and things like that. What's sort of the latest that you're learning from people?
COVID was fantastic for some autistic young people and traumatic for many autistic young people. So it suited some brilliantly. Some people didn't have the overlay of the social interaction at school and could just focus on their work and their interests. For some, the lack of interaction face-to-face removed all the prompting and reminders and little people systems they had in place at school and had a traumatic impact on their experience of learning. So it was COVID was a range of extremes for autistic young people. And we are a community of extremes, let's be honest, in a wonderful way. And so we experienced COVID in its extremes. That's probably one insight. We did a study this time last year on the impact of COVID on 11 families who, for a range of reasons, really faced barriers with the education system. And that was one of the insights. It was traumatic for some, and for others, it had moments where it really worked. In terms of other insights, there's, you know, increasing acceptance of autism, which is a wonderful thing. I think we can all see that, which is great. There's increasing belief in programs like ICANN Network. So we're seeing, you know, the autistic-led approach being championed far more. We're seeing things like the Information Linkages and Capacity Building Scheme of federal government talk about disability-led organisations. We're seeing things like empowerment and self-determination being promoted. And this was all not language that was around back in 2012, 2013, when I was setting this up. It was not, you know, I felt alone, and I had people tell me, you know, your idea is too risky. Autistic people cannot carry corporate duties. I was told, don't do this. And, you know, there are so many other autistic-led groups now, and that's awesome. You know, we know from all the previous, I guess, rights-based movements that it takes a rebel to champion something, and then, you know, people join. And I know that's a bit cocky of me to say, but I think we were a huge pioneer in autistic-led service provision. I think
there's no doubt about that. That's very obvious to an outsider like me looking in and learning from the beginning. Absolutely.
Yeah, so that's I'm really proud that we've played that role. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you should be. Thank you for doing it.
Oh, no.
Because it's helped so many people, and it's been a major part that's influenced me and my journey. My whole experience is the know better, do better thing.
Yeah.
Where I was in the other camp and have come across and realized I didn't understand why I was doing it wrong, but I do now. So I'm now going to do better. So thank you for being part of influencing me and on that journey. I think there's many others like me.
It has been an amazing journey. I'm almost at the 10-year mark.
You know,
the baby's turning, getting into the double digits area. I'm a real dad now. I have a little boy, but, you know, I always feel like a bit of a dad if I can, and it is, I'm very proud to work with the people I do. It's so much fun.
Oh, well, I think that's a really lovely note to finish on. The only other question I often ask guests is about mentors, books, or influences that you might want to share with us. Is there anyone that you would like to sort of mention that the listeners can sort of look up, or anything? You don't have to, but.
Oh, no, I will. my first thing, look, I am immersed in an autism culture, so I can't pretend that I read every book of every autistic advocate out there. I actually don't read much. I'm a Harry Potter, Lord of the Rings history nerd. Yeah. So I stick to fantasy worlds and history of England and France.
But that's probably a good thing.
It's a great thing. It's an amazing zone off. I love that.
We need an escape. Yeah.
But I would say, if I had to give an example, I love Eunice Kennedy Shriver, The Kennedy Who Changed the World. That would be a book I'd refer people to. I think she was an amazing woman, pretty unsung, member of that family. And I just love the way she went about it. She, and I probably, I take a lot from her book. I think she was great.
Well, that's really good, because that's something very different, which I guess is not surprising.
No, it wouldn't be surprising for me, because I went into this not, you know, just going, well, I've seen it work in other spaces. We need a youth-led program that does this, and there I did it. I didn't read 1,000 books by autistic advocates, and I haven't.
I think when you really know you want to do that's how I feel about this little podcast, is I just thought, I've got connections now to people like you, and even though it was hard to get you, but I've got a lot of really fantastic, knowledgeable, lived experience experts in the field, and I think I need to bring them to these young families. I mean, you mentioned before the young families, that is what motivates so many of us, is trying to help them to not make the mistakes that I made, and also just make the experience a joyful one, because it shouldn't be this awful burden and negative, horrible disaster. It's not at all. And once you realize your child is just awesome and amazing and wonderful how they are, it just takes all that stress away.
Yes.
So, yeah, let's do it. Let's keep doing
it. Thanks, Louise. It's been lovely hanging out with you.
I will sign us off if you can just hang on for a second. Thank you so much, Chris. I'm glad we did it.
Thank you.
Acknowledgements. Thank you to Carla Cushell of Carla Cushell Creative for the podcast logo and the website. Editing by Matt Cushell. Images and episode quotes are the work of Jazzy C. Music is also by Jazzy C. Finally, a big thank you to my friends and family for encouraging me. As always, thank you to my partner in everything, Ash Cushell. And remember, just be nice to one another.